Hi and welcome back to another episode of Millennialism. Every week I sit down to chat with a guest about a topic that interests me. I've had entrepreneurs, award-winning authors, esteemed academics, pioneering filmmakers, TED speakers, philosophers, and friends come on the show to discuss everything from social media to health, business to culture, and personal development to global travel. Every week when I record this, I'm constantly wondering for whoever is listening to every episode how tired they must be of this intro. But anyway, I still want to do it in case there are any new listeners. Millennialism is the podcast for anyone who wants to learn more about anything and everything related to life as a millennial. If you ever have any recommendations for guests or topics that you would like me to cover, you can get in touch with me on my website, adamgavin.com. Email me hello@adamgavin.com or just send me a message on Instagram @adamgavin. I just said my name a lot of times. In this episode, I am joined by author, speaker, mountain climber, college professor, and women's rights advocate, Sarah Safari. In 2015, she received the Global Citizen Award from the United Nations Association and is currently on track to become the first Iranian woman in history to climb the seven summits. That is the highest peak in each continent. Growing up in Iran after the Islamic Revolution, Sarah enjoyed very little personal freedom and few rights under the law, living an existence marked by oppression and limitations. In response to her childhood experiences, Sarah was motivated to empower marginalized women everywhere. And what better way to show young girls that they can do anything than to stand on top of the world, literally. She recounts her experiences of overcoming these challenges and adversities in her books, Follow My Footsteps, Above the Mountain's Shadow, and Making a Difference. Today we talk about Sarah's climbing experiences, setting big goals, overcoming challenges, what inspired her to take on this seven summit challenge, how a near-death experience can change her perspective on life, and what is truly important. I also asked Sarah what it means to her to have come from such adversity, to become an inspiration for young girls and women all over the world today. It was truly a privilege having her on the show, so please enjoy this conversation with the admirable Sarah Safari. Sarah, welcome to the show. It's good to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to talk with you today. You're an extraordinary person from what I've read and from what I've seen so far. So I'm really excited about this. So I just want to start and jump into it. You're originally from Iran, but moved to the US in 2002 to study electrical engineering at UCLA. So what made you move to California and study electrical engineering?
I was kind of forced to study electrical engineering because my dad was an engineer and he told me you have two options. You either have to study to be a doctor or an engineer. So I didn't like blood, so I just had to study engineering. And I was good at math and physics too. And choosing California, again, I didn't do anything about it. I didn't even know there is a California. I thought this is just a whole United States. And my family moved to the U.S., so I didn't even know there's a state called California. I was actually really disappointed when I saw California because I was expecting to see something like New York, like high-rises and stuff, and I didn't see any here, so I was really disappointed. So for those two decisions, I didn't do much. My family kind of took me from zero to that. That's why I had to change directions when I was 30, because now I could make my own decisions. Until then, you know, as an Iranian woman, I felt like I never had a voice. I never could make my own decisions. And then when I actually realized, there are other things to do in life and there are other ways of being and living, then I changed my direction.
Well, it sounds like out of the two choices you made, electrical engineering was the only way to go. So what's it like for you now when you've grown up and you have your own like independence and freedom to make your own decisions? Like what's your relationship like with your parents now that you're free to make your own decisions?
Well, I'm thankful to them because they eventually made good decisions for us, me and my siblings. I'm very thankful we have good relationships, but, you know, they are more coming from a traditional background. So their view of life is very different from my view of life. they are still have the Iranian mindset of women, we need to be very careful, because I have two other sisters and I see how they want a very traditional life for us. You know, they want us to stick with a 9-to-5 job, to be safe, to have good insurance, to get married and have kids. And it's much harder when you grow. Yeah, I'm growing up half of my life almost. I've been in U.S. and the other half I've been in Iran. And now I get to see how much opportunities are here. So I try to explain to my parents, like, they don't have to worry and there are so many options here. I don't have to stick with certain plan to be safe. But I understand this is all coming from their love. They want us to be successful.
Of course. As I understand it from what I've read right now, you work a lot with, you're an advocate for human rights and empowering young women to study and to have their own personal freedom. And I read that as a young girl in Iran, you had, as you just said, like you had, didn't have that much personal freedom and few rights under the law. But then when you came to the US, you knew kind of there had to be something better, or you were more free to make your own decisions. So I just, like, how do you think your upbringing in Iran influenced your interest in women's rights and empowering young girls?
Growing up in Iran, I experienced firsthand the oppressive, restrictive environment that makes gender discrimination possible. I saw women around me, like my mom, my little sisters, my aunt, our neighbors, never have opportunities. They can never achieve their goal. They never can go for their dreams. They just had to follow certain protocols and they had to live a certain life to survive. And this was, and I, you know, like every other woman in Iran, I had no idea that this is possible. I was, you know, how the fish inside the water, you don't see it. You don't see the outside. The water is everything you see. Like for me, that was the norma. I thought the whole world is like this. Until we moved to US, and it took me a few years to actually see that how I was treated back in Iran. I had no idea. I thought that was the normal. And so when we moved here and I saw what's possible, I felt so much responsibility. I couldn't just live a normal life. I saw that, well, I'm one of those few people, few women that had the opportunity to come to a country that now I have access to so many things that many people all over the world, especially Iran, they don't have access to. So now I'm responsible for empowering other women in those countries. Doesn't matter which country. In the countries that women, because of their culture, because of the economics, because of their religion, because of whatever, people are dealing, women are not empowered. And they need to know this. And that's why I decided to do women's empowerment.
That's really great. One of many reasons why you kind of stood out on the long Excel sheet of people I had that I wanted to interview is that you're the first woman from Iran to climb or ascend the world's the highest peak in every continent in the world, which is amazing. It's called the Seven Summit Challenge. I've heard about it before. And it's I really respect and admire everyone who's done it, because it's like, sure, you need the money to do it, but no, it doesn't matter if you're a billionaire, you're not going to get up any easier. Like, it's all about willpower and determination. But before you took on this challenge, you had no previous climbing experience. So what led you to start this insane journey?
You probably heard it already in my TED talk, but I was in a seminar and the leader of the seminar said, come up with an impossible project. And, you know, I was a simple electrical engineer, thanks to my dad who forced me to study engineering. I was just working as a simple engineer and with zero experience. We don't have anyone in my family and extended family who have ever climbed anything or even hiked anything or went up a hill, like a small hill. nobody exercises or works out in my family. So it was so out of my comfort zone, like mentally and physically. And I heard that thing that the leader of the seminar said, and I said, well, for the first time in my life, I want to do something impossible. And that's how the journey started. The journey was just all about me challenging myself to do something different, to prove to myself that I'm strong, that I'm capable, that I'm somebody, that I can do something impossible. It was very, very personal, kind of egoic, to be honest. I just wanted to sit up there and say, see, look at me, I'm so good. You know, it was all about that.
Yeah, that's incredible. So when did you start this, when did you take on this adventure? How long ago was it?
2012. I decided to climb Mount Everest, and 2015 was the first time that I climbed Mount Everest.
So how many tries? Was it the second attempt?
2015, when the earthquake happened,
okay,
that was the first time, which I didn't make it. Yeah. After that, I tried a few more times, a couple of more times. I broke my arm, I got divorced, and then the pandemic happened. So that... this year, they closed down the whole Mount Everest. So nobody from, except China, the rest of the world couldn't climb Mount Everest. So it's 4 years that I've been trying, but something happened in the world that I couldn't go climb the mountain.
Yeah, I want to get back to that earthquake story. You talked about that in your TED Talk as well. This huge earthquake hit when you were just like climbing up this icy wall. And you thought you were going to die. What's it like after that moment when you realize, like, all right, maybe I'm safe. I will survive this. Like, what's going through your head?
Well, after thinking that I'm dying, how did it feel like? Well, the feeling of death was so overwhelming that it took me 2-3 months after that moment to recover from it. You know, for two, three months after that, I was re-seeing that moment over and over and over. Every time that, you know, there was a shake, not because of the earthquake, you know, if my bed was shaking, if the, I don't know, whatever happened, like the car was moving, it felt like an earthquake. So recovery from that moment took a long, long time. That's why I had to write a book about it, because I had to just write down everything, that all the emotions that I had, all the feelings, all the anger and sadness from past, present, and future. I had to write it down to be able to digest and understand what happened on that day. But overall, I tried to make lemonade out of my lemons. That day was a very unfortunate day. 10,000 people died, 100,000 people lost their lives. But, you know, I kind of, that was the moment that I realized I want to dedicate my life to women's empowerment. Because the location that I was on the mountain at 20,000 feet, for your audience, 6,000 meters, you know, that elevation and Khumbu Icefall, it's so unstable, even without the earthquake. It's just, it's unpredictable. At any moment, any piece of ice can break down on you. And now add a 7.8 earthquake, and we were on a wall. So the fact that I survived that, and then the aftershocks and then avalanches after that for the next 8 days until we got fully rescued back in Kathmandu, I think that was the turning point in my life. That's when I was 100% clear that this is my calling and this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And that's when I decided to do the 7 summits. Because before that, it was just all about Everest and empower Nepali girls. And then after that moment, I started thinking about, okay, why just only Everest? Why just only empower Nepali girls? I'm going to expand this project. So that was a turning point in my life.
That is absolutely crazy. I was like, when I heard you talk about it for the first time, I was just almost shaking myself. I've read a couple of books of people who climbed up Everest and just being able to cling on when, as you said, like thousands, 10,000s of people died on the ground and you were up there on this mountain and actually survived. I can only imagine that you must have felt a strong calling to, or a big reason why you survived in order to help all these people. And it is very important to mention, as like you said, that you're not only climbing for yourself, you're climbing for other people as well. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the causes that you are climbing for. Mm-hmm. and the work that you do.
So originally, it only started with Empower Nepali Girls, which is a nonprofit organization. Now I'm a board member. We have 300 girls who participate in this program. They are scholarship students, so they receive a scholarship to provide to continue their education. And these girls are in 14 different towns, 14 different villages and towns. And, you know, some of these girls might become victims of human trafficking or are forced to get married at an early age. I don't know if you've been in Nepal or not. It's a gorgeous, beautiful country. They have Himalayas in their backyard, but at the same time, they are just so poor, even though they are such a kind, peaceful people, but it's a very poor country. And there are a lot of human trafficking going on in Nepal. So this organization has been founded in 2002, and since then they increased the number of girls. So this is the first organization that I started working with, which means that I promised that I raise $1 per foot of Mount Everest or any mountain that I climb in preparation for Everest. So my original goal was Everest is 29,000 feet. I'm going to raise $29,000 for Empower Nepali Girls, which pays for 150 girls to go to school one whole year. And I thought, okay, if I just do that in my life, I'll be fine. I can die. I'm done. But after the earthquake happened and after I decided to climb the seven summits, I added six more mountains and six more organizations. So the highest peak in Africa for Tanzanian women, and Europe and Asia was already taken. But when I climbed the highest peak in Antarctica, which is Mount Vincent, you know, there are no schools or anything in Antarctica. So I had to pick another continent to raise funds. So I picked this organization who is in Iran, Tehran, and who's helping Iranian and Afghani women who are victims of abuse and violence. And then I also climbed the highest peak in Europe, Mount Elbrus, for Syrian women who are refugees in Jordan and Iraq. And then I picked two organizations in Americas, because the highest peak in South America and the highest peak in North America. So overall, it's seven organizations in seven continents, except Antarctica. There are no nonprofits in Antarctica, which I chose an organization in Iran. These are the organizations that I'm working with and raising funds for. So each mountain, I raise $1 per foot of the elevation, and that's the amount that I raise for that organization.
That's amazing. So where does the money come from? Do people like donate onto your website or to you or to the organization via you, or how does it work?
Yeah, it's mostly recently has been on my website. At the beginning, I had a lot of big events in my home. I would invite friends and family and neighbors, and I asked people to buy 100 feet of the mountain, 200 feet of the mountain. And the money they donated would go to the organization that I was climbing for. But recently, I made everything online so they can go to my website, Climb Your Everest, and they choose their organization that they want to donate to. And the link is directly connected to that organization. And they are all nonprofit, tax deductible, and people can just directly go read about that organization, research it for themselves, and donate.
Yeah, I'm gonna leave all this stuff in the show notes. But for anyone who's listening who doesn't know anything about climbing, I've heard stories of like all these mountains, all these seven different mountains around the world. There are professional climbers who've been climbing their whole lives who are not able to do this physically or financially for a bunch of different reasons. How did you start preparing for all this, and what did that process look like?
At the beginning, I was just so inspired that for the first time, I'm doing something that is 100% mine. I made up this decision. It's not coming from outside. It's not the society telling me to do it. It's not my parents telling me to do this. This is all me. And I was just so excited about it that all the savings that I had, that I was an engineer, so I was saving to finally buy a house when I'm a little older. I decided to use that for climbing instead of buying a place. And so that was helpful. And as it gained some momentum, friends and family introduced me to some organizations who wanted me to advertise for them. And in return, they would help me with my climbing costs or gear or hiking clothing or some of the food that I have to take with me for athletes for the mountain climbing. You know, so like from different I was receiving help, and as it was growing and growing and growing, more people heard about it and more people wanted to be a part of this. They started giving me a lot of donations for the girls so that I can take with me to places. They started helping me also with my climbing. So those two were very separate, but I was receiving help from outside and also my own, all my savings. And so that was that part of it. But time-wise, I was teaching in two different schools by the time that I was climbing Everest. And Everest takes 60 days. So I had to take off from work 60 days. So I had to talk with two different schools and convince them that I'm going to be gone for 60 days and my students and, you know, everybody. And even though I came back because the earthquake happened on day 25, and anyways, after 35 days, I was back. But still, it was just very, it's been very challenging. You know, I had to develop a lot of skills. It's not just climbing skills. And I had to climb so many mountains, first of all, to gain the experience to be able to climb a mountain like Everest. Because a lot of people show up on Everest with really not much experience. I met people who have climbed only one other mountain and they were on Everest. I mean, they're physically, they're very strong, but not in terms of experience with the 8,000 meter or very high altitude mountain. So there are all kinds of people on the mountain, especially on Everest, which is a very commercialized mountain. There are all kinds of expeditions from all over the world. And so it took me a while to learn and realize which companies I'm more interested in, which guides, what kind of services I need to receive. I want to pay for, because then at that point, you really need to decide if I want one more capsule of oxygen or I want this, you know, we really have to pick and choose. And, you know, it was very challenging. It's like any other big decisions in life. It involves a lot of learning, a lot of hardship. But I think these are all learning experiences, even though I had to do many things that I had no idea. Like for the fundraising, that was very challenging. I was such a shy person. I couldn't even ask my own mom for money. Now I had to go to these perfect strangers and ask for money for these other perfect strangers. And that was very challenging. I learned a lot doing that. So this whole experience, even though I paid big prices, but at the same time, I learned very big lessons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the shift your life took a couple of years, like 10, 8 years ago or whatever it was, it's pretty significant. So what did your like husband at the time and your family like make of all of it when you suddenly went from being an electrical engineer, like stable job in California, to traveling around literally every continent in the world and climbing the tallest mountains in the world? Like, what did they say?
I don't know. I think at the beginning, you should ask them. But
I'll have to call them up after this.
I think at the beginning, they didn't take it very seriously. They thought that I'll just climb one mountain and I'll be done with it. But as I was doing it, I just realized this is amazing. This is my calling. After doing it for a little while, I realized that how amazing this is and how much I'm learning from this. And I decided to really convince them by talking to them. It was really hard, actually, you know, like talking to them to convince them that I'm kind of risking my life for other people, but this is what I really like to do in my life. And, you know, sometimes I had to talk with them for hours and hours and hours. I took my parents to the gym and I showed them my workout so they feel more comfortable about my physical readiness. I showed them every single climbing gear that I had and I explained to them, okay, this is an ice axe, this is what it does, this is the brand, blah, blah, like explaining to them how good my gear is so that they feel safer, they feel more confident in me. I had to go online and show them the route of the mountain, the company, the guide, everybody that I'm climbing with, how experienced they are, how professional they are, so that they feel more comfortable. And the other thing was, as I was doing all that, I wasn't even sure what I'm doing. I wasn't sure that if this is, I'm going to survive this or not. But I had to pretend in front of my parents that I got this and I'm on top of every single element, which really everything was so unpredictable.
I guess it's about like convincing yourself that you can do this as well, because like I said earlier, professional climbers have tried to do this and failed before. So,
I mean, I haven't still made it to the top of Everest. That shows that how unpredictable this thing is. And our life is, and the COVID is also here to show us everything is very unpredictable. Just you don't have to, you just live at this moment, at the present moment, and do your best. And there's, I mean, like this says that we cannot plan anything. And, you know, climbing all these mountains really taught me so many lessons that I can use in these times, which I really appreciate.
I can imagine. I actually have a question about that, but further for the end, maybe.
Okay.
And I just had to mention that there is absolutely no shame in not having made it all the way atop Everest. It's unbelievable that you've even like gone back after everything that happened with the earthquake and everything. It's insane. Maybe a little bit crazy, but in a very good way. So for someone like me, because I'm very interested in like climbing, I've watched tons of climbing documentaries and read books about it, two books about Everest, but I still have no idea what it's like to stand atop of a tall mountain like that. Not Everest maybe, but from the other mountains, like what does it feel like to stand like on top of the world, literally?
I'm going to really disappoint you at this moment.
Just very, very tired, I guess.
Yeah, so the highest that I've been was Chuoyu. Chuoyu is 8,200 meters or 27,000 feet. And Chuoyu is next to Everest. So from top of Chuoyu, the very first thing you see is like Everest. It's like right there, right in front of you. And you just want to jump, stand on top of that and be done with this. But that was the first thing that I thought. When I was at the summit, I was like, okay, where is Everest? And then they're like, that one, the tall one. And then I'm like, just so close. So standing on top of Chuoyu after the expedition was 45 days. So it's day 30 when we are standing on the summit, or 32, I don't remember. When I was standing on top of Chuoyu, I was tired. I was sleepy. I was hungry. I needed more oxygen. And I was just thinking about what I'm going to eat as soon as I get down the mountain. And I was just thinking hamburger and fries. And, you know, so that's one part of it, to be honest. It's so windy and negative 40 degrees and cold and uncomfortable that you're just really thinking, okay, done. Let's go back down and eat. And then the second thing I was thinking about, okay, let's take at least one picture so I can show people that I was up here. And my cell phone and my GoPro, they both died. I could take only one picture. So I have a proof, but just one. I mean, other people in the expedition, they took many pictures. So I'm in their pictures.
Witnesses.
Witnesses. Yeah, I have. Yeah. But the other thing is like the beauty of the scenery. You're standing on top of one of the tallest mountains in the world. You really see the curve of the earth. And you see all these tall mountains, like 8,000 meter mountains around you. And everything else, like a 7,000 meter mountain, like a 23,000 feet mountain, looks so short. And you get a perspective. It's a very humbling experience. You get a perspective of how small you are compared to the nature, compared to the universe. It's a very humbling experience. And the feeling of success and like accomplishing and achieving your goal, for me, it happened like 3 days after the summit, when I could actually rest and sleep enough and get something to eat and take a shower. And after 30, 40 days, I finally took a shower. That was when I realized that I summited the mountain. But the top of the mountain is just, it's not very comfortable and convenient.
So now, like being back in California and reflecting on all these experiences, what's it like now? Does it feel like a dream, or can you look back and like, yeah, I did that?
Both. You know, sometimes I close my eyes and I see view from top of the mountain, view of the sunrise and sunsets on the mountains, and you know, in very high elevations, like there is nothing except ice and snow and orange, just orange, because all the snow and ice look orange. And it feels like a dream, but I know I've done it because I have so many pictures and videos of myself doing that, which are all available online. And but at the same time, I'm still reflecting. Like the experience was so grand and sophisticated, and I had to deal with so many things that I couldn't process and digest it as it was happening. So now that I'm sitting here, after many, many years, I climbed Chuyo in 2014. That was 6 years ago. So I'm still 6 years after, I'm sitting and I'm thinking what I learned. How can I use those lessons in my daily life? What can I teach to other people? What can I teach to my students about my experience? Not many people are able to climb Chuyo. So I'm trying to see how I can use that experience and benefit my life and people around me. So yes, I'm still processing, dreaming about going back, seeing the mountains again, and meeting new women. Of course, I'm always dreaming about
it. It's nice like seeing you talk about it, because your whole face just shines up. I can see you're like thinking back at it. You were kind of getting there a bit earlier, but about the like life lessons you learned and how we can implement them in these times. So I was just wondering if you could share some of those.
You know, the number one thing in the mountains is unpredictability. You have no idea what's the weather would be like. You have no idea who are your teammates. You know, most of the time there's going to be people who join on the same expedition most 90% of the time, I don't know anybody in my expeditions, and I get to know them throughout the days as we are climbing the mountain together. But just there are so many unpredictable facts about every single element, from the weather, from the mountain, from the avalanches, earthquake, of course, the people that you're dealing with, their moods, their experiences. It's so unpredictable that I've been practicing for the past few years to be okay not to know the future, to be okay not having any plans and still enjoy the moment. And it's not easy. It's really hard, especially when you're risking your life. You want to know, you want to have a very solid plan. But in the mountains, there is no solid plan. I mean, anything can go wrong at any moment. And it reminds me of our situation, how every day the news tells us something very different from the day before. And the economics of it, the number of people who lost their jobs, like all the emotions around it, and all the news and all the research, everything about the situation is very unpredictable. And it reminds me of the mountains. And I keep telling myself, you know how in the mountain, whenever you had a pillow, you were happy. You know, like when I was in the mountain, I always thought, I just want to go back down and sleep on my own pillow. I only want to take a shower. Because, you know, after 34 days of not taking a shower, the only thing you're thinking about is a shower. And I just want to use a regular restroom. I'm tired of these rocks and stuff. And so now, every day that I am very frustrated with the situation that we are dealing with, I just keep telling myself, you're healthy, you have a pillow, you have warm food, you can take a shower, actually, and you have a regular restroom. Stop complaining. And that's how I keep myself grounded, even though there is no ground right now. It's so groundless. But that's the main lesson. I can talk about this specific question for an hour, yeah, but I'm trying to keep it short. The most important lesson.
That's great, and I can imagine like how humbling it must be, and what the perspective you get after doing something like that. When you're, because we just, most of the time we just go through lives, we do the same things every day, and I think climbing Everest or one of the other six mountains is like, that's, it's almost like the biggest challenge anyone can take on physically and mentally as well, just being out there for so long, not having all the comforts of home and risking your life every day just to get like further up a mountain. It's crazy. What do you think is the most important message you're trying to communicate with maybe young girls or women by doing this?
Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of women in developing countries that they don't have the opportunities that we have. You are in Sweden, I'm here in US. We are very lucky. We are very fortunate that we live in these countries. But there are so many developing countries and so many women out there that they don't have basic opportunities, like basic access to health, to education, to very basic things. So my hope is people who are hearing this, they try to reach out to organizations who are helping women like this. Because, you know, women are half of the population of the earth. Most of them will be future moms. So it's really to empower our planet, empower the next generation. It's very important to empower women, educate women. We won't have a very good life on this planet if half of the population is not very empowered. So I think that's very important. At the same time, if you don't want to reach out to any organization and help them financially or by volunteerism, just try to empower the women around you, your kids, your niece, your neighbor's kids, your aunts, your grandma, whoever you have. Women around you who are really trying to go out of their comfort zone, just say thank you, acknowledge them, just try help them to get to the take their life to the next level. And I think for me, helping other people is makes me the happiest. There is nothing else in the world that makes me as happy. And I figured this about myself. And that even if it is really, really small, that that's what makes me really, really happy. And I think for a lot of human beings, like imagine yourself, or like people who are listening to this, imagine yourself when you were 5 years old and you saw somebody fell on the ground, or you saw someone struggling. By instinct, the very first thing we do, we go for help. We don't think about our resources. We just go and take care of that person. And now we are older, so we have this, we develop this logic, and we think about resources and benefits, disadvantages, disadvantages, positives and negatives. But inherently, human beings are, they want to help each other. We are very social beings, and I think that would make everybody happy, not just me, like helping other people. So just reach out, even if you help one person, just think about the butterfly effect. That person will have generations of people after him or her. Just helping others in general will totally change our earth. This is where we're going to live in. And so that's the number one thing that I got out of this. You know, by the project, the name of my project was Everest. Originally, I was supposed to climb Everest. I climbed it, but I still haven't summited. I don't know if I care about summiting Everest or not. And now it's all about the things that I'm learning as I'm trying. And every year, thankfully, a new thing happens in my life that I cannot climb Everest or I cannot summit Everest. And it's been like this for a while. Maybe I'm supposed to stay in this part of the journey and learn new things. So for people who are listening, you might not want to climb Everest, but you want to get a promotion in your job. You want to get a degree for your education. You want to have a baby. You want to have a better relationship with your mom or your dad. That's your Everest. That's the Everest you are dealing with. And you don't have to summit it. You don't have to get to the top of it. Just trying, trying, and trying to get there. That's the most important part of the journey. And I really want to encourage people to stay with it and focus on the positive side, which is the lessons that they are learning as they are trying to get to their own Everest, to get to climb their own Everest. And that's what I've been telling myself, that, yeah, you still haven't made it, but keep trying, because this is such a big learning experience.
That's such a beautiful message. And with all this, you just answered like four of my other questions. But that is such a great message. And as you say, like, maybe it's not about conquering it. It's just about keep trying. And that's a great message to send. And you're such a selfless person, and your whole life at the moment, or in the last few years, have been all about like empowering other people. But what does it feel for you, like personally, to be the first Iranian woman, or just for you personally to have conquered all these incredible mountains?
I stopped caring about being the first woman. The most important part of it is that I just wanted this to be a gift for all the Iranian women who haven't had a chance to pursue their dreams, and not just Iranian women, all these developing countries, all these cultures, patriarchal cultures that women are dealing with on a daily basis, they never get to be what they really want to be. This, I wanted this to be a gift for them. But I still haven't made it to number 7. I don't know if I make it to number 7 or not. But just, I think now the gift is the gift of trying. I'm trying. I'm doing my best. I haven't made it. But I'm hoping that I can give this message of keep trying. Keep trying. And never get disappointed. Even if you go a very, very small step, that still counts. And even if you help one person throughout the way, get one small lesson, that still counts. And
Let's not forget that you did actually ascend 6 other incredibly tall mountains. Yeah. It's just Mount Everest that's left. So it's like you're making it sound like a failure. Like it's not a failure. It's
no,
incredible.
No, it's not a failure. No. Not at all. I don't even believe in failure.
No, it's absolutely breathtaking. And I mean, it's like you said before, and you speak about in your TED talk about conquering your own Everest, all about like trying to overcome that challenge in your life and whatever or however big or small it may be. And that's a great message to send and a great place to kind of wrap this up. So I just wanted to ask you as well, like, where can people find out more about you, the organizations you're an advocate for, and how they can show their support, especially in these tough times?
People can find more about me and my project on my website, which is climbyoureverest.org. My YouTube page and my TEDx talk, they all have the same name, Climb Your Everest. And also I'm in Facebook and Instagram and all that. You can easily find me on those, and the information is on my website.
Cool. Well, I cannot tell you how glad I am that you joined me here today. It's been fascinating to hear. I've just been sitting here with my jaw dropped all the way and a smile on my face. It's been such a great time talking to you, so I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot.
They made a statue of us.